Get a tease, Matadamon, and welcome to De Monosophy. This is a response and a unpacking resulting from a recent short that I made regarding the Bhagavad Gita and the idea that one of the interpretations of certain passages from the Gita leads one to the conclusion that it is not possible to exist in this world without destroying other forms of organic life, that is part of the law of existence in the world on planet Earth, that to exist here as an organic being, you must destroy other organic beings. You must consume or other organic beings. So there was a response on here from Dreamland Mavu, who said, mashing up an apathetic law from mindfulness and the Bhagavad Gita is a gross misinterpretation. So my first response to this is that there is no universally true and accurate interpretation of the Bhagavad Gita, or really any of the super texts like the Gospels or Secret of the Golden Flower and other things like that. There is only the interpretation and the understanding of the one who attempts to absorb or read such documents or study them within themselves. So really everyone should take up the Gita and study it for themselves and find their own meaning of it. That's the best possible result. However, of course, not everyone in the world is going to do that. Only those who are drawn to it for whatever reason will, as is the same for any of the other super texts. And for some others who have taken them up, they find within themselves the desire to try and articulate their understanding of it, because by articulating and attempting to articulate, one learns more about the subject at hand. One gains yet a further perspective on it. So there is value in the articulation beyond being beyond producing a right and truthful and fully accurate interpretation for anyone else who might read it. So that's my first suggestion to Dreamland Mavu. Here's to you. I'm glad that you have an interpretation. I don't know exactly what it is, because all you did is tell me that mine is wrong. But that's okay. I understand. There's those short responses on a forum. So I appreciate hearing back from you on this, because it's given me an opportunity to think more about it. That all being said, now point number two that I would make is that I don't think it was a misinterpretation. In my view, obviously, it was not a gross misinterpretation. However, I'm more than happy to dive a little deeper into the Gita itself and unpack why I might have presented the interpretation that I did. So I'll share with you some lines from it here. These are from chapter 2 of the Bhagavad Gita, where most of this comes from. So Krishna says, the material body of the indestructible, immeasurable, and eternal living entity is sure to come to an end. Therefore, fight, O descendant of Bharata. So this is Krishna responding to Arjuna after Arjuna has a breakdown on the battlefield of Kushetra, and says he doesn't want to go to war. He doesn't want to slay his kinsmen. He thinks it's wrong. He's just going to lay down his bow and he's not going to fight. So Krishna, now taking this opportunity to reveal his teaching to Arjuna, has begun thus. The first point he makes is to understand the material body of the indestructible, immeasurable, and eternal living entity is sure to come to an end. Therefore, fight, O descendant of Bharata. In other words, the material bodies of the opposing soldiers, be they your friends, family, or whatever, they're all going to die anyhow. Everyone is going to die and experience suffering anyhow. So that's the first point. You're not saving anyone by not destroying them, because in the great scope of time, everyone is due to end anyhow. He continues, neither he who thinks the living entity the slayer, nor he who thinks it slain, is in knowledge, for the self slays not, nor is slain. So here he's talking about not the physical entity, he's talking about the living aspect of our being, the spiritual aspect of our being, the non-material aspect of our being, the part of us that is not the apparent body, is not a slayer, nor is it slain. It doesn't kill people, doesn't kill other organic entities, other organic life forms, nor does it itself die. For the soul, there is neither birth nor death at any time. He has not come into being, does not come into being, and will not come into being. He is unborn, eternal, ever-existing, and primeval. He is not slain when the body is slain. So this addresses not only birth and death, but the idea of growth or coming into being, appearing in being, is not something that happens to the divine aspect of ourselves. The divine aspect of ourselves always was, always is, and always shall be. Yeah, now, the caveat is in greater or lesser awareness of that, because our awareness, our consciousness, our attention in life ends up becoming enmeshed in that outer part of us, within the material body, the physical brain, and such what. And so that part will die and go away, but that part is only the outer body, and the inner part exists forever. O Partha, how can a person who knows that the soul is indestructible, eternal, unborn, and immutable kill anyone or cause anyone to kill? So the external part may destroy other things, for it must in order to exist. But the inner part, the eternal part, the divine part, is not able to kill anyone or cause anyone else to kill, for it is whole and complete within itself. As a person puts on new garments, giving up old ones, the soul similarly accepts new material bodies, giving up the old and useless ones. The material body is like an outer coating for the inner immortal aspect of our existence. And it changes. It changes, first of all, throughout our lives. We always like to take these words as referring to the idea of reincarnation. Souls comes back and takes a new body. That body dies, and then the soul comes back, takes another body. So that's certainly one way of looking at it, and that is one possible interpretation. Another way of looking at it is how that the material body effectively dies and changes throughout our life at a cellular level. Science and medicine tell us that every cell within the body that makes up your physical body within a 24 or 48 hour period has died and been replaced by another one. So really, materially, day by day, you are physically a different person. And it's just as much your divine consciousness that gives you the sense of being the same entity day by day as much as your body does. On another level, this can refer to the idea of the different personalities or multiple eyes that that we are in possession of. It says in the New Testament, my name is Legion, of the man who is possessed by demons. My name is Legion, for we are many. I must call myself we, for we are many. We are multiple personalities that shift day by day based on whim, circumstance, happenstance. And in that sense, as every new personality, which does manifest through my physical presence in the world in order to interact with the universe, it is the real me who is behind all that, the real permanent I, the real essence of our being, does return through different cells. Just in the course of a day, in the course of a few hours, can return through multiple cells. So this idea of as a person puts on new garments, giving up old ones, the soul similarly accepts new material bodies, giving up the old and useless ones. So this is where they use the analogy of putting on different clothes, putting on different suits, which we all just know on a very basic, simple, intuitive level, that we change our outward appearance based on need and circumstance. Yet within somewhere, there's something which maintains a continuity of our existence, a consistency of our existence, and that is the divine aspect within us. He says the soul can never be cut to pieces by any weapon, nor burned by fire, nor moistened by water, nor withered by the wind. For these are all aspects of Earth, aspects of the planet, aspects that interact with the planetary body. For the planetary body is made of the same substance as these things of Earth, wind, and fire. Whereas the divine nature is made of a different quality of substance. It is composed of substances from a cosmic level, from a higher level. Therefore, it is not subject to being cut to pieces by any of the things of earth. One who has taken his birth is sure to die, and after death, one is sure to take birth again. Therefore, in the unavoidable discharge of your duty, you should not lament. And here he is talking about that to take birth means birth into the planetary world, into the material world, or the world of gross material. You might say, for there is a materiality to the divine as well, but of a much finer quality. So sometimes it's easier to just conceive of it as non-material and the earthly world around us to be as material. But that birth and death are an assurance in the world of material. The world that Gurdjieff calls Do 48. World 48, we are subject to 48 laws. That birth is most assuredly to precede death, and in turn, that death is most assuredly to follow birth. Death must occur before birth, in fact. And this is the one thing that in the ordinary world of knowledge, the world of the rational mind, we have trouble thinking of it in that way. We like to think of birth at the beginning and then death at the end. Birth precedes death. But as you begin to ponder much of this esoteric material, and it appears numerous times in the Gospels, like in Corinthians, when Paul is talking about the nature of the seed, and he says the seed must die so that it can be born. It appears again and again. And this is one of the initial truths that we must ponder when approaching this question of a higher conscious existence, is that death precedes birth, just as birth precedes death, and birth and death, and birth and death. We must die to our old selves. The old personalities must die so that new awareness can emerge. There's numerous levels on which this pattern takes place. And one of the important ones that certainly Krishna is making here and explaining this to Arjuna is to help him understand that it isn't the real him, the real permanent I of his existence that is carrying out his duty to the planetary world of having to destroy other beings. It is really it is simply his material aspect that does this. It is the clothes that he has put on that he must wear as a part of his existence here. O descendant of Bharata, he who dwells in the body can never be slain. Therefore, you need not grieve for any living being. So know the real self, the real spiritual nature, the energy nature, the life force energy of all organic beings, which flows to all organic beings, is not destroyed by the destruction of their material or apparent existence. And yet your duty obligate you to destroy it. And so this is where he says to Arjuna, who is, again, Arjuna is a member of the Kshatriya caste, which is the warrior class, which his duty or dharma, which is a concept similar to fate or weird or Gurdjieff's park dog duty, is that he destroys other human beings in order to protect others, destroys the evil, the attacking, in order to, you know, defend the defenseless and the deserving. So Krishna says to him, considering your specific duty as a Kshatriya, you should know that there's no better engagement for you than fighting on religious principles. And so there is no need for hesitation. If, however, you do not perform this religious duty of fighting, then you will certainly incur sins for neglecting your duties and thus lose your reputation as a fighter. So this is one area where I think people go in some different directions in interpreting the Bhagavad Gita, specifically about the caste system. Some people take that it's literal, and it's a form of classism and endorses slavery, and that's part of the old patriarchal aspect of the Bhagavad Gita, that we need to kind of like look around it. And then another way of interpreting it is that it's not really to be taken entirely literally, but that he's also talking specifically about duty, and that the Kshatriya duty of having to destroy other organic beings is a really great illustration of the extreme nature of having to follow Dharma. In other words, following Dharma, following one's duty, becoming aware of one's duty, isn't just a matter of, you know, withdrawing from life. A lot of people think of it like that. A lot of people think of any kind of like spiritual conscious pursuit as, oh, I'm just going to withdraw from the world and avoid it. It's the idea of monastic isolation. But very much the nature of the Bhagavad Gita, and he talks about this more in that chapter on renunciation, that the way toward enlightenment is not to renounce life entirely, but to renounce one's attachments to the results of it. And in many ways, this initial discussion of it here is a drill down to that idea, taking the extreme example of a Kshatriya or a warrior class, which you would think, well, if I'm going to pursue like spiritual enlightenment, I can't like, you know, stay in the army. You know, anyone who's in the armed services today should be able to quickly identify with the paradigm of the Kshatriya class that's being explored here. To do one's duty, one must be prepared to kill people, and in many cases, you do have to like go and destroy other people, specifically with that. So in the greater sense of understanding the caste system is that all of us experience all castes. In one sense, all of the castes, the four castes, just represent different aspects of personalities. So, you know, we have a religious, wannabe pious personality. We have the warrior personality who has to, you know, go out there and have conflicts with people in the world. We have the merchant class and professional class personality, where we focus on, you know, honing our skills and being a householder. And we also have our worker personality, where we, you know, drill down and just get busy with things. So it's another way of understanding it, is the caste system, is that every divine individual, divine essential being, has this outer veneer of multiple personalities and goes through all of, like, the different castes. And again, you could take that to the level of reincarnation, because that's the other idea, is people, like, come back with reincarnation. Every time you come back to this world, you progress through the caste system, you know, from the bottom up to it, or eventually you start out as a lowly worker, and eventually you come back as a Brahmin. Again, you can take that within the law of eternal recurrence, within just the unit of one's individual life, that just in my own life, I come back as different castes. And he's using that extreme example of a Kshatriya, because that's the caste, which is specifically their job is to destroy things. But again, all throughout my life, even if I'm not at war with anyone, I am destroying things. And this is the point that I was making, that I think the person objected to the most, is that, well, I have to destroy other animals in order to eat them, or I have to destroy plants in order to eat them. I have to destroy the cells in my body, because there's nothing I can do about it. They're going to destroy themselves. They're going to give up the ghost anyhow. Or, you know, if I, you know, I, you know, scratch really hard, I got, you know, itch here, well, that got a bunch of dead skin cells, you know, flake off there. So, well, I just killed, like, you know, maybe a million, like, living cells there when I just scratched myself. So, oh, look out. Oh, I just stepped on a bug, you know. I mean, you can't help but destroy other living beings by existing in this world. It's just the nature of it. And that's one sense in which he's communicating here. That aspect of reality is the role, the sense in which we all experience the dharma of a Kshatriya. If, however, you do not perform this religious duty of fighting, then you will certainly incur sins for neglecting your duties, and thus lose your reputation as a fighter. So what this is basically saying is that if you do avoid performing your duty, and you can infer this beyond that to the other, whatever other duties you have to do, that you don't actually make anything better. And this is getting back to the idea of renunciation. That is not to be taken as a full, literal renunciation of all of one's life and existence, but rather renunciation of the results of one's actions, or what Aleister Crowley liked to call lust for results. Same ancient idea, but Uncle Al put it in a nice, contemporary, occultish package. So you can ponder it from that direction if you find that more flavorable. But the idea is this, that by total abstinence and renunciation, really you just make things worse. And finally, on the question of yourself, well, he says, O son of Kunti, either you will be killed on the battlefield and attain the heavenly planets, or you will conquer and enjoy the earthly kingdom. Therefore, get up with determination and fight. So, again, even for yourself, if you want to abstain from fighting with the world because you're afraid that you're going to die yourself, take courage in the fact that the real you cannot be destroyed. It cannot be destroyed by anything. And you can take it as, in the Platonic sense, you take that as it's the divine self is not material, so it can't be destroyed by material things, like the material body can be destroyed or eventually degrade and fall apart on its own. But if you take all of this in a non-dualistic and totally materialist sense, which I do, and which I believe many of these ancient systems really were based on, and certainly Gurdjieff's system is totally based on the idea that everything is material. What it means is just that a lower level of materiality can't destroy this higher, finer level of materiality, because they're of different qualities. So there can be an effect with it, but they can't destroy each other. And this also has to do with the different laws. Say, like, a higher level of materiality would be comprised of less laws. Let's say it's comprised of, like, there's like 12 laws, and the realm of material reality is comprised of 48 laws. Well, it's like those 12 laws are still consistent within it. So they flow down, and the lower level partakes of those 12 laws from above, right? And then carries that through its 48 laws. And then the next level of 196 laws takes all those 48 plus another 48 on top of that. So it's that consistency of the 12 and what is within that that goes on up to the absolute, which is the indestructible nature of it, or quality of it. So you don't have to be a mathematician in order to grok these things, but what we try to gain through work, through the prolonged effort of awakening something new within us, is not just the mental understanding of these ideas, but the sense of it and the feeling of it and the knowing that there is something else within us that is able to survive through what perishes on the outside. We have a moment of self-remembering where you realize all the different roles you played throughout your life, and that all of them are essentially dead now and gone forever, and that you have, something within you has remained consistent and continuous. Then you are one step closer to understanding what is meant by that sense of permanence, that sense that there is something within you that cannot die, and that helps fuel the courage to be able to let go of the known and have trust in something higher that can transform you. Thank everybody who gives you the question, and thank everybody who gives you the opportunity for internal struggle. Stay true, go against the grain, and keep the dark fires burning.